call to order the meeting of the Senate Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development and the House Committee on Land Use on the today, the 18th of June, 2013. And I want to thank the people who agreed to be here. As many of you know, in both our committees, we had a number of bills about annexation this year. And it's my belief as we get going that I anticipate more next time. In fact, I anticipate annexation bills almost every time we come to Salem. And so it's better to start building a repertoire of knowledge about annexation amongst people who are going to be on committees. And you know, I am really grateful that we have some outstanding people who volunteered to be here today, and we appreciate that a lot. And I think I speak for all the committees. We may have people coming and going as we get close to the end of the session. There are some people who are asked to do certain things and get pulled away from us from time to time. So with that, we will start our informational meeting on annexation and infrastructure funding. I like to call it Annexation 101. And so with that, we're going to have Christopher Crean, an attorney with Berry Eschler and Hammond, LLP, and Pamela Berry, partner with Berry and Elsner and Hammond, LLP, to come on up. And I know they have a little presentation as well. And
thank you, Chair. Are we on? Okay. Thank you, Chair Roblin, Chair Clem, for the record, Chris Crane. As you mentioned, I'm of counsel with Berry Elsner Hammond, a firm started about 15 years ago by my colleague here, Pam Berry, and her husband, Paul Elsner. And it's important to understand the firm, we limit our representation, our client base, exclusively to local governments. Pam used to be a Beaverton City Attorney, was with the City Attorney's Office there for about 10 years. And so we represent about 12 to 15 cities, everybody from Hillsborough down to Willamina. But not just cities, we also represent community college districts. Clackamas Community College is a client, special districts, Baldwin Hills Parks and Rec. So what we do is local government. And so next to me is Pam. As I say, she was with Beaverton City Attorney's Office for 10 years before going out in private practice and then starting this firm. And as you may recall, I was with legislative counsel for about 6 years through four sessions in the late 90s and early aughts. You also should have, hopefully on your computer, a set of materials that I would like to say we put together, Pam mostly put together. It's really an extensive, very extensive analysis of boundary issues covering city annexations, special district boundaries, and various forms of infrastructure financing. The infrastructure financing piece is at the end, and if you look at it, we'll get that to that at the end of the presentation here, but it's much more than LIDs. We'll touch on that, but it's much more than that. So with that, I'll turn this over to Pam.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you again, Chair Clem and Chair Roblin, for the opportunity. Though we represent local government, we're hoping to present an unbiased view. This is an educational presentation. I know some of our colleagues in the back of the room may question that, but I think they'll find that it's fair. It's an objective presentation. You should know that in addition to the PowerPoint, as Chris mentioned, there's a detailed memorandum. I don't expect you all to read that today, but I do hope in the long run, as you confront these issues going forward, that it'll be a resource for you. It's up to date. I know folks will pick it apart if they think I've missed anything, but I think it's absolutely current on the law as it stands today. It covers everything from island annexations, which I know you've dealt with, all kinds of boundary change issues, special service districts, and so hopefully it'll be useful in the long run. Today, since we have limited time, my understanding is you'd like us to give a 45 or so minute presentation. We're going to jump right in. So the overview of the presentation, as you can see on the first slide, is what we're going to try to address the charge of the committee, and that is the committee asked us to talk about what are the legal methods of annexation to cities and special districts. What's the relationship between annexation law and land use laws? And finally, a primer on a few options for financing infrastructure. And as you've as you guessed from your questions, financing of infrastructure is key in annexation decisions and has been kind of a bugaboo for many years. So the first slide lays out the overall presentation, and I will tell you also that looking at this list of statutes here, which is on slide two, it's daunting. There are five ways annexation can occur to cities. The fundamental principle that I think you need to understand, though, is that all of them require either consent from a combination of landowners and voters, or a vote of the people. And we'll go through that very carefully as we talk through the options. There is an appendix
with,
to the
material.
Go
exception.
Ahead. Except for Island.
With one exception.
Two exceptions.
Two exceptions to that. The first is Island annexations, which do not require either the consent of the property owners or a vote. And I'd like to point out that just last Friday, LUBA issued a decision in a Forest Grove annexation case under the statute that is the first decision under 215.750 since it was amended last in 2007. So the law, not just the statutes change, but the law is evolving even while the statutes stay in place. The other way that property can be brought in, I think, is frankly
health hazard
annexations. Mm-hmm. That's right. And I don't, it doesn't happen very often, but I do remember, I think, in the late 80s, what is now the east side of Portland was in unincorporated Multnomah mm-hmm. County and was brought in under the health hazard annexation statutes. So those are the two examples where property can be annexed without the consent of the people or a vote.
That's right. Thanks, Chris. And I think we have a little bit of, on that later. Not yet. So back to the authority to annex. There are two, as Chris alluded to, just to start everybody on the same page. There's statutory law and there's case law. So the statutes lay out the processes, and the case law has embellished that in a couple of ways that are probably of particular interest to the committee, which we're going to talk about. The first is... First, I want to talk about city authority to annex. Cities don't have inherent authority to annex. Cities have broad home rule power, but people often get confused about what city authority to annex is. The home rule power exists only within city boundaries. So the annexation statutes are what give cities authority to annex. And that, coupled with the applicable case law, is what sort of puts the sideboards on what cities can do in this arena. I think a lot of people think that it's home rule authority, but it actually isn't. Another important point to note throughout these processes, and again, there's an appendix to the paper that you should have online. It's a cheat sheet, which, frankly, after 30 years of practice, I still use, that goes through the five types of annexation and then islands, and has little cheat sheet on who has to agree to what in each case. So it's hopefully be useful to you in the long run. In addition to these processes in state law, cities also can have charter requirements that have to do with annexation. My understanding and my research for this is that 31 cities in Oregon currently have a voter approval requirement in their charter. Charter for a city is its constitution, so that's the way cities initially govern themselves in addition to their laws. So this is the universe of the state laws and the city charter. A little bit more about islands before we switch one thing. They've been controversial, and as Chris said, we had a significant amendment in 2007 and still case law developing on islands. The thing about islands is, as Chris mentioned, it's one of the two ways that you can annex property without consent. Effectively, some people call it lassoing and some people call it circling, but cities can, by annexing roadways and other devices, encircle a property and then bring it in against the will of the property owners. And that is, as you may know, probably know, the reason that 222.750 was enacted to prevent that from occurring. And so the memo goes through the list of requirements for island annexation, and the courts have not looked favorably on those either. So they've imposed a Costco decision out of Beaverton, has imposed more thresholds on islands, and it's a special case. The other thing that I will say on the city authority topic is that the boundary of the annexation has to be reasonable. Courts will look at what the city did and determine whether the boundary is reasonable. That's an independent standard over and above what you guys have adopted in state law. So though the bar is low,
cherry stems
are okay. For example, and you've probably heard about cherry stem annexations where a city will go out a road and then grab a piece of property. The St. Helens case was sort of the poster child, and before that the Estacada case, and those cases both determined boundaries were reasonable. In St. Helens, I just looked at it so I could tell you, it's a 1,500-foot stem roadway out to a target parcel that the court determined was reasonable. So it is a low threshold, but nevertheless, the city has to have valid planning reasons to go out and capture a cherry, if you will. Okay, let's see. We're over here. I'm trying to move quickly so we can cover everything. We have a lot on elections and so forth. So let's move quickly to special districts. If you're following the memorandum, those of you on television are here, we're on page 7. Special districts are different than cities. Cities are home rule. We just discussed that. They get their power through the Constitution and then the charter that the voters adopt. Special districts are creatures of statute, and all of their actions are governed by statutory authority. There are two kinds of special districts, just to get everybody on the same page here. There are special districts, which examples are on slide 4 here, rural fire protection, for example, water supply districts. Then there are county service districts, which are formed by counties, generally to serve urban areas outside the fringes of cities to provide enhanced services. Washington County has an enhanced sheriff patrol district, for example, or clean water services in Washington County, where the county governing body serves as the governing body of that special district, but it's specially set up to provide an enhanced level of urban-type service in an area that is not within a city. Does that make sense?
And politically, it's important to understand that each of these has its own governing body that are separately elected. The county service districts, there's a lot of overlap because the county service district board is also typically the Board of County Commissioners. But special districts have an entirely separately elected governing body. So if you have any in your district, I know I got to be very familiar with Marion County Fire District and Representative Clem's district, entirely separately elected board. They also have a different separate tax base. They're very similar to cities and other local governments in the sense they can issue debt, they can hire and fire employees. They're an entirely separate local government with their own tax base and governing body.
And yet, you can go to slide 5, the annexation requirements and provisions with respect to special districts are very different from cities. The statute ties annexation and boundary changes for special districts to service availability. So it's a specific requirement that the district be the service provider, and we've cited the statute there. Also, special districts can annex territory that's not contiguous, in other words, that they don't otherwise touch with their current boundary. Again, the inquiry for the County Board of Commissioners, which makes the decision, is whether this service can be provided by that district and whether that makes sense for the folks living there. The county board decides those petitions. There is a little bit of a wrinkle in the law that provides that if 100 electors or a certain percent of the folks that live in the area that would be annexed file petitions, then it can go to a vote. So again, we have this sort of dual voting and petitioning process that applies. There's controversy. You're going to hear from some of the folks who are going to talk after we talk. One of the big political areas of concern is the fact that cities can withdraw territory from districts when they annex. And we'll talk a little bit about legislation that I know Representative Clem's familiar with that we worked on that requires the city be the service provider if it's going to take that territory from the district. But what happens when a city annexes territory, the statute says that a city can annex the territory, it becomes part of the city, and at the same time or later can withdraw it from the boundaries of the special district. So if we're following the money, which is really what this is about, the money, the tax money that was being collected by the district that formerly had that property within its boundaries is now going to the city when that property is withdrawn. If enough of those happen, the district begins to lose area.
Liability.
And at some point, it becomes either too small or not dense enough or overall collecting not enough property tax revenue to remain in existence. And that is obviously a huge concern, and that's what motivates some of the political issues around special districts and city relationships and annexation. Property owners can also withdraw, as we note, from a special district. They can get out. It's kind of hard. There's a statutory process. I won't go through it because it doesn't happen very often. Highly political, obviously. Go ahead. And quickly, you asked about how annexation law and land use law relate. Another very sensitive topic. You've hit on some really interesting little tentacles that I know they're founded in things you've been dealing with here. After a long time practicing, the land use piece of annexation and boundary changes has created yet another layer of complexity, as you know. So annexation is a land use decision. The Supreme Court in Oregon made that decision first in 1977, even before the statutes required it. Now the statute requires that annexations comply with the statewide land use goals. There's a complex interplay then between those statewide goals and the annexation land use decision, which I'll talk just a little bit about given the time we have. If an election is held, though, remember, some of the annexations go to a vote either by charter or because there's not enough property owner consent. That election isn't a land use decision, thank goodness. It makes a lot of sense that it wouldn't be. It's a voter enactment. It's not a city action making a decision. So that has taken litigation to determine that, though, over the years. So it wasn't a foregone conclusion. You can go to 7 when you're ready.
One of the interesting things about this we discovered in the Marion County litigation last year was that a decision by a special district to annex territory is a land use decision, but a decision by the city to withdraw territory from a special district is not a land use decision, just because of the way the statutes are drafted and cross-referenced. So in that case, there were two decisions, one to withdraw the territory from the special district. The city made a decision to withdraw territory from the special district. Review of that decision went to circuit court. The subsequent decision to annex that territory into another special district was, in fact, a land use decision, and that went to LUBA. So there are, you know, it gets very complicated very quickly.
Yeah, we had 5 different pieces of litigation going at once, trying to make sure we were in the right forum. It's very confusing who has jurisdiction.
And the other thing is, please forgive me for thinking out loud here, but it's important to understand that the fact that land might be inside a UGP has very little to do with any of these issues. There is lots of land inside urban growth boundaries that remains in the county that is not annexed to the city, and so it remains zoned for rural uses, county uses, unless you're in one of those counties that has urban densities like Clackamas, Washington, Lane, and some others. You know, theoretically, all the land inside an urban growth boundary is supposed to be available for urbanization, but getting the annexations to occur, getting public facilities out there may or may not occur. And so it's not uncommon at all, frankly, the point I guess I'm trying to make is that the connections to land use have very little to do with whether or not something is inside or outside an urban growth boundary.
You with us so far? We're moving fast. Okay. So another related topic then, when you're talking, Chris, it's a perfect segue into the provision of public facilities. Because annexation is a land use decision. It's subject to the statewide goals. One of the statewide goals is number 11. It requires that public facilities planning occur in a coordinated fashion between cities and their affected local governments. So it sounds simple, and yeah, it's a great idea. It sounds like it makes sense. However, on the ground, it's a lot more complicated. I can sense by your questions that this ability to provide service, it is one of the big problems. And in Washington County in particular, there are large areas where service is woefully lacking and there's just no ability to extend infrastructure. And as Chris said, that makes annexation sort of a moot point. If you can't provide the service, annexation doesn't do the city any good in terms of providing land for jobs or land for housing. The new statute, again, that came into being this session, House Bill 2618, as a result of the Marion County case, requires that if a city is going to withdraw that property that we talked about from the district, they have to be either providing the service or paying for it. They can't just take the property out of a district and hand it to another district to provide the service. And you would think that would be sort of analytically obvious, but it wasn't in the statutes, and so we passed new legislation to make it clear. A whole city can be annexed into a special district as well, very rare, but just want you to know it's out there.
Give an example. I think I mentioned this to the Senate committee when we were discussing 2618, but an example is the city of Beaverton. Used to have a fire department. They discontinued their fire department and annexed the entire city into Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. What that does then is Tualatin Valley, TVFNR's permanent rate then is applied to all the properties within the city. The city had been funding its own fire department, but now has that money available within its budget for other things. So there are ways. And another example, although it's not it wasn't an annexation into a special district, but we saw a similar thing with Multnomah County, created a special district to provide library services. So the money this county had been spending on that is now available for other things.
Mm-hmm. So there's an inherent tension between the governance and the money, and who can provide the service, and it isn't always a neat package. And that kind of leads to the next topic. We can switch to the Senate Bill 122 agreement. So the idea, it was a good idea at the time. In 1993, the legislature enacted this series of statutes in Chapter 195. The idea was that we would coordinate all this stuff. So this has been a problem for a long time. I mean, it's not a new problem. It's over 20 years at least in the making. And the idea was that the cities, the counties, the special service districts would all sit down and agree on how best to provide the service, where boundaries would exist, whose area of interest was what. There were going to be maps, and everybody was going to agree, and we were going to march forward, arms locked together, and provide the best service for the lowest cost, most efficiently. It's a great idea. I know of one county that has done a Senate Bill 122 agreement, and that's Washington County. Others who are going to testify may be able to tell us there are others. It is an incredibly challenging thing to do, as you can imagine. When you think about getting these special districts together that want to maintain, understandably, their service area and their revenue source, cities who want to provide jobs and housing want to maintain and increase their boundary areas, provide the full range of services in most cases, and urbanization that has incredible pressure to occur. Cities are not just randomly running out and doing a land grab. There are people moving into cities, and we have to provide services for them. So there's that tension, and the county is the coordinator for these agreements and has to call everyone together, or in the metro area, Metro is theoretically supposed to do it, but they haven't done it. So Washington County called everybody together. There was an agreement signed, and it's still in place, and all the service districts signed on to it. Two of the service districts had special appendices attached to that agreement because they couldn't live with the agreement as it was written, but in order to get it done, there was a creative solution. And there's still no answer to how the services are going to be provided or who's going to be providing them in Washington County. It's a classic example of the attempt and the idea. It's wonderful. I should tell you, it's not in the materials. We represent the city of Hillsborough as their city attorney, and in that capacity, we worked with the Washington County Urbanization Forum that you might have heard about. It was an important effort, unprecedented effort, that was looking at this problem and trying to come up with an actual lock arms and march forward solution to the whole problem of funding the county, not having enough money to provide services in areas like Alloa that really need them, Hillsborough wanting to provide jobs and housing for their massive economic development growth that's going on, the service districts having an interest. Everybody came together, all 27 of them, and we spent months trying to revitalize the agreement that we did have and to figure out what to do in terms of service provision, getting money to the counties, what legislation would be needed to update and really make this a functional plan. And we just couldn't reach agreement. Our firm served as legal counsel to the whole forum, and so we provided an analysis of all the options, and it just couldn't get done. So sorry to throw a problem up without a proposed solution. I don't like doing that, but you need to be aware that it, as far as I'm concerned, it hasn't worked very well, and we're still stuck with the problem. So that was going to be the quick overview of boundary changes. It's tough to do something this complicated in this short a time, and it's, as I said, the paper is way more detailed. I don't know if you want to stop for questions at this point or just plow through.
One quick question, yes.
I think I know the answer, but I need somebody smarter than I am to clarify it. So when a city wants to annex some property, it has to go up for a vote.
Not always. No.
Well, one of the scenarios is it goes.
Yes.
Who votes on it? The people in the city or the people that are going to be annexed?
That's a good question. So if you look at our cheat sheet, there are times when the territory itself votes. Okay, so you can have an election in the annexation area. If you have all property owners consenting, then obviously no vote. If you have what they call a double majority, no election, and a triple majority, no election. So it's based on that there needs to be a certain sort of upwelling of consent from various levels of they consider ownership of property, whether you're registered to vote in the area, and what the value of the land is that you own. And in the triple majority method, all three factors have to be there, and then you can bypass the vote anywhere. Nobody votes. If a city charter requires a vote, then the city residents vote, unless the charter has no power to require a voter anything outside the boundaries, okay? And then if you're just annexing an area without anybody's consent, it has to be voted on by those people. Does that make sense? One other thing I would say about triple majority there, who was it that said rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated?
Mark Twain.
So triple majority annexation was dead. It had been ruled unconstitutional by the Oregon Supreme Court, I think. If somebody will correct me if it was the Court of Appeals. And then in a series of cases out of Madras, that was another of those thread of complex, very messy annexation decisions that occurred a few years ago in the early 2000s. The triple majority method, the court overruled the Mid-County Future Alternatives case, which had been the one that killed triple majority annexations, and it's now a viable mechanism to use again, and that's again the one where you consider the value of the property, the ownership, and if you're registered to vote. And so all of those people coming together can force an election without a vote. Did you want to interrupt me?
And where there is an election, it requires the majority in the territory to be annexed to approve the election.
Right.
So it's not, and Representative Clem, I think, is an expert in this area. So it's not the case that a city could approve an annexation over the objection of the territory to be annexed.
And in Island, oh, wait. Go ahead.
Yeah, the one thing you'll get into occasionally is some people will say, I'm not in favor of this, but they or the developer who sold it to them has signed a piece of paper saying mm-hmm. you won't contest this later. So they're counted as in favor. They might be standing at city council going, no, I'm not. But then someone will hold up the paper saying, yes, you are.
That's an excellent point.
And that's come up. I heard some testimony about mm-hmm. some legislation on that issue. And it's not an uncommon scenario around the states, particularly where a city will extend services outside of its boundary. They say, sure, we'll give you water or sewer or police or whatever, but you have to agree when the city's ready, you have to agree that you'll be annexed. And then they say, okay, fine, just give us the water. And then 10 years later, when the city goes to annex, the property may even have been sold, and the current owner might not even know that the consent was given and recorded in the deed records. And then up it pops, and you can't really object at that point.
Yeah, You might see legislation, I know you have in the past, that would try to limit or otherwise either the length of those consents or how they're recorded or some other protection. I know you've seen it, I'm sure you'll see it again because it's a sore subject for folks. Thank you for bringing that up, Representative Clem. The last point I would make, just to give a complete answer on the island annexation, because of the special legislation that we mentioned in 222, the election has to include both city and district electors. That's the only one where it's a dual vote. Okay.
So we're so do, in that case, do both groups have to approve?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions right now? Okay, so then the next topic, the third and last topic the committee requested information on was financing local infrastructure. I will say that I understand now that on Thursday we're coming back to present on local improvement districts, which is one of the things we'll talk about today. You'll have a more detailed presentation then. But let me preface this discussion about financing. It's, again, it's as though you reached out and found all of the sore spots and just said, we want to hear about that. So this one's another one. And that is that cities, you know this already. I was just reading one of the court cases that I reviewed just to be fresh for this presentation, and Justice Gillette, in a dissenting opinion, noted how what a difficult time cities are having doing their job in light of Measures 5 and 50. It's an old saw down here, but I have to say that it has had a real impact, and it's now the rubber's hitting the road. If you haven't heard this, or I'm sure you've heard it almost daily. So the cut and cap is real, and it's starting to take effect in a big way on city budgets. The citations to it are there. I'm sure you know where it is. It's in Chapter 310. So now we're reaching compression. Compression, again, is when the $5 and $10 taxing limits for schools and general government are hit. Then if anybody passes a levy or has a taxing rate that's over that cap, everybody has to share the pain, and everybody's is compressed, if you will, on a pro rata basis. So that's what compression is. So local governments are pressed, and it's not just cities, it's all of them. And that, for example, that's a good example why Multnomah County has basically outsourced its library to a special service district to get additional money. It's a way around that because the voters approved it. So local governments are turning to some creative and some old infrastructure financing mechanisms. As we said, financing infrastructure is one of the main barriers to land development, both inside and outside the urban growth boundary. So we did a quick survey. Others may have some ideas that we missed, but these are the top few financing options that we were able to pull together with our brain trust at our firm. The first one is local improvement districts. Creature of statute. This is the one we're going to talk about on Thursday. This is the one where the city builds the improvements and the benefited properties pay. Now, benefited properties is one of those sore points in local improvement law. Who's benefited? The boundary is currently drawn by the city council in a city LID based on an engineer's report that determines who's going to benefit from whatever the improvement, whether it be a road, a sewer, water, whatever the improvement is. There is a detailed statutory process for creation of LIDs, and it requires notice, it requires a hearing, it requires a pre-assessment hearing and a hearing before you, what you call spread the assessments. So it is process-laden, I would say. We have worked with some of our clients to develop forms, but it's difficult to do. You have to go through, there's a lot of notice and process that's required. The big thing about local improvement districts is that the resulting assessment becomes a lien, and that lien has first priority by state law above a mortgage, okay, unless the city agrees to go second. So cities then have the ability to foreclose on those liens if they're not paid. And what the law also provides, there's a corollary called the Bancroft Bonding Act. Most cities actually finance these themselves. In other words, they'll just do the improvement and then collect the money over time as property owners pay. Property owners enter into agreements. They, again, statutorily regulated in terms of what they contain. Payments are between 10 and 30 years on a usually semi-annual basis. And then if they're not paid on time, there's a foreclosure possibility. And as I said, we'll talk a lot more in detail about that Thursday, but that's just the quick overview. Is this same group hearing the Thursday presentation? Oh, just this? Okay. Okay. Another one that we like to use, which is not a statute thing. It's something that we, I think, came up with. It's called a reimbursement district. This one is a local tool. What we've done to authorize a city to undertake a reimbursement district is provide in the local code for virtually identical process to a local improvement district. Notice, hearing, opportunity to comment, engineer's report, benefited properties, everything is the same. The big difference is there's no lien. And the reason that's attractive is because there's no lien. City councils are, in our experience, reluctant in many cases to enact anything that will impose a lien on property. Some may not be, but many are. And so this approach then allows the developer to build the improvement, not the city. The developer then later would dedicate any public improvement to the city, just like they would in any subdivision development. Benefiting properties then reimburse the developer over time. And the city effectively only collects the money when building permits are issued. So we have a mechanism where we have people at the counter and they want a permit from us, we tack the developer's fee on, collect it from the benefiting properties as they develop over the life of the reimbursement district, typically 10 years. This mechanism was challenged in a case that came out of the Woodburn Company Stores, is that what you call them? The big shopping center on the freeway there. Dispute over who had to pay for all that road work. And there was a reimbursement district that we helped the city of Woodburn form. Developer didn't like the payment plan after the road was already built and everybody was using it, and so challenged the idea of a reimbursement district, and the Court of Appeals upheld it. So it's been tested and it's a valid tool, no lien, but still difference is then the developer builds, not the city, and no lien. Okay, so that's another tool.
A quick example, the Sherwood School District built two schools recently, and in order to develop the properties, they had to bring road, sewer lines, water lines across some undeveloped property. And they came to the city of Sherwood, one of our clients, and asked to create a reimbursement district. We agreed, we got the engineer's report, and the costs of the roadway were allocated to these other properties based on, I think, frontage and area, whereas the water and sewer were allocated to other properties based on the area, the assumption being as those properties develop, they'll divide up, you know, whatever to whatever the zoning allows. And the mechanism says if those properties develop within the next 10 years, the developer has to pay that fee. They come to the city and they pay it. That's the developer's risk. If those properties don't develop within 10 years, they lose. But the city was not going to form an LID, and so that was the only way that the developer could conceivably get a return on these improvements they had to make. That one also went up to the Court of Appeals and was affirmed based on the Baker decision.
One financing tool before we get to the system development charge I failed to mention was special levies. You're probably aware of those. I just want to add them in the mix. They're in the paper materials. Those are the 5 or 10 year special levies that require voter authorization that many cities are using to add additional property tax revenue over and above their Measure 550 capped rate. So, but those are limited in time and also have to be reauthorized. Yes, sir.
So in the reimbursement district, all the infrastructure is put in by the developer.
Yeah.
And so they have all this investment.
Yeah.
And they have the right through the city to get that back as they develop it.
And it's their risk.
Or they lose it all.
They may lose it all.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. It's their risk. But, you know, it helps them if they are anxious to do something and the infrastructure isn't in place, you know, they're the outlying property and the sewer line isn't there yet and they really want to develop that. It's a tool that has been used successfully to help them get their developments done.
It's not unreasonable. If you think about a cul-de-sac, and if the bulb of the cul-de-sac develops, well, that developer put in the road, and now all those other properties that could develop along the stem don't have to build a road, but they shouldn't just get that for free, so they should reimburse the developer for their portion of the road cost.
Yeah.
That's sort of the theory.
Everybody pays their fair share is the idea. Okay, moving then to another subject
of fun.
Frequent legislation, almost every session since enactment, I think. System of development charges, creature of statute again, a tool available to cities, counties, and special districts. Again, a public process mandated by statute to adopt it. I know John Chandler's here, and he and I have worked many times on legislation to tweak that process, tweak the requirements for the, you know, everything. Right, John? The idea is, and he has to agree with me on this, but the idea of a systems development charge is, again, that development should pay its fair share. And that's how it's designed. And in its best application, that is what happens. Ideally, then, what the city or county or special district does is forecast the 100% cost that they're going to be required to pay for infrastructure. We'll pick it's sewer, water, streets, you know, the standard five services, parks. That you have a total budget, and over time, theoretically, development that is putting in the list of improvements on your list, as you check them off, you should be collecting 100% of the cost, and everybody will pay their fair share. So you never make money as a city. You just make sure that the infrastructure gets built and that everybody who should be paying for it pays for it. That's how it's designed to work. As I said, there are imperfections, many legislative changes, lots of court cases that you need to be aware of. One is, and I don't think they're on the PowerPoint, but they've been challenged not only here in Salem, but in court on a variety of theories. It's been argued that they are a taking. We now know just recently, based on the Westland litigation that you may be familiar with, that money is not property. It's not real property. And so it's not something you can take under the Constitution like you would condemn real property. So that we now know. So money, the payment of money is not a constitutional problem. There are cases that determine whether it's a tax or a fee. There are cases that challenge the reasonableness of the fee as applied. So there's a lot of body of law out there about SDCs. So if amendments come up, maybe at that point we'll be talking about specifics that you need to know. It's not just that set of statutes. There's also a lot of case law that's
and we can built. Come back next week and talk about that. Yeah. So, Chair Clement, if you want to talk about that.
It's fascinating.
And on the SDC, it is the body that determines what it should be. So Water yeah. Board makes the determination, and they also, their engineering tells you, your development's going to take a pump station, then that's part of the SDC?
Yes. Typically, the local government will either hire consultants to, if they are small and don't have staff, to develop the what's called the project plan or capital improvement plan and develop cost estimates. So there's an engineering estimate. And good programs are updated periodically with a cost index and as projects are built and are come in over or under that cost. So it should be a moving, living document over time. Sometimes the in-house staff will determine what the cost is, but what is needed in terms of improvements is developed either by in-house staff at the local government or by a consultant. And again, that plan, that list, is required to have a public process for its adoption, so it isn't developed in some back room.
Let me add to that. It's important to understand that the projects on this list, you know, there'll be five categories. We've got your parks. We want to do these three park projects. That's going to cost X. We've got these roads. That's going to cost Y. And you total it all up, and that gives you your total amount that you're going to need. But these projects are supposed to be citywide projects that everybody's going to benefit. These are not projects that, I mean, which is why this cost is shared broadly. So once you get to your total cost of all these projects, you look at your planning and your zoning plan, you figure out how to allocate those costs across the city, because when you leave your neighborhood, you take arterials to get all over town. You don't just use the roads in your neighborhood, you use every, you know, the large streets. Everybody should share in the cost of those streets. So that's really the theory behind this. These are big capacity building projects that everybody in the city will use, and that's why it's fair to spread the costs around the city to every development. And it's done on various methodologies, residential versus commercial, so on and so forth. That's what you hire the experts for. But these are big projects that are supposed to benefit, capacity building projects that are supposed to benefit the city at large. And that total number is then generally spread across the entire city in your SDC rate. And it, I do think it's important to note that it's not always, it oftentimes is not 100% recapture. Mm-hmm. Cities will often say our SDCs are calculated to recover about 70% of that total project cost. So you got all your projects listed out, you got your total cost, and our SDCs, I think Sherwood, they've got a 60% recapture, and the other 40% comes out of their general fund or levies or some other source. So
and that's an economic development engine, a tool. It's right. in a sense that you don't want your charges so high that you
scare away development.
Bring housing to a halt or, right. or prohibit economic yep. development. That's a very good point. And the other thing I guess I would add is back on, Chris mentioned capacity increasing. Those changes have been made incrementally over time to the statutes. There are two kinds of SDCs. There's a reimbursement fee, which reimburses the city for excess capacity. That's not capacity increasing. But the other charges have to be designed to serve new users. Okay, so they're uniquely, as Chris said, I mean, they're designed to be, they're not cities filling holes in their budget for things that they have already done. It's to serve the new growth, and that's
For example, if your development needs an 8-inch water line, but it's going to cross some undeveloped territory, and you put in a 12-inch line, so that it's going to be big enough to serve that land that you don't own, and somebody else will benefit from it. You can get credits for the amount of excess capacity that you just put in.
Yeah, that's a good point. So we don't have there's a lot on system development charges. We don't have time to cover it all. Credits and how they work and all that. It's just too much for this presentation. Two other things we want to cover really quickly then, in the very limited time we have. Bonds are another revenue source. There are two basic kinds of bonds. There are general obligation bonds, which are voter approved, because it puts the full faith and credit of the issuer at risk. In other words, it puts the general fund, the tax money, at risk to repay them. And so, of course, it makes sense you'd want to have voter approval to put your own property tax payments at risk. Cities, counties, and some special districts, not all, can issue these. And as I said, the repayment is guaranteed by the full faith and credit, and that's why they're called general obligation bonds. The thing that is standing in the way of these being used widely is that they're expensive to issue. You need to have a sufficiently large amount that you want to go out to the market to sell bonds with in order to justify the cost. They're highly expensive. The other thing is market uncertainty. You have to go get a credit rating and to issue bonds, and then you never know on the day you go out and sell them exactly how much you're going to get, because it's so variable depending on the market volatility. So you need to hire a bond counsel and a financial underwriter. All of that's expensive. So it really isn't a tool that's very useful for small communities or ones without a lot of resources. The other kind is revenue bonds. These don't require voter approval because the only thing that is guaranteed to pay them back is revenue from the facility you're building. So if you build a parking garage and you plan to charge $4 a day for parking, and you can anticipate X number of cars are going to park there, you have to demonstrate a revenue stream, and some investors are willing to purchase those on the thought that they are going to get paid back. But as you can probably guess, not used as often either, because it's hard to document that you're going to generate revenue from a public facility sufficient to pay that back. There's a third kind of bond. It's a hybrid called a double barrel bond, which you've probably heard, which pledges both revenues and the full faith and credit of the city. Those are also voter approval required. The last tool, another very controversial one, but still in use. It was, again, rumored to be dead after some of the tax revisions and some case law, but there are still urban renewal districts operating in Oregon. ORS Chapter 457, highly regulated. Again, this is the statutory option where the property tax bill stays the same. So the property owner pays the same amount of money to the local government collecting, usually the county. And a certain amount of that money is effectively siphoned off and handed over to the urban renewal agency, which is why it's a sore subject. Because as you can, when you know that there's only so many tax dollars under measures 5 and 50, any siphoning off will reduce someone's share. So special districts can lose. They don't like urban renewal generally. Cities and counties can do it. The way you form one, it doesn't require voter approval. That's another reason why some people find it offensive, because it changes the structure of tax dollars, and it doesn't require a vote. Did you want to say
I would mention, I think it does, as a result of recent changes in the statute, require approval of 75% of the affected taxing districts. So
For a new plan.
So if a city wants now to go out and establish an urban renewal district, they have to get the consent of a substantial number of the affected taxing districts.
Mm-hmm. That's right. What we said to abbreviate this presentation was it's a complex public outreach process. It includes outreach to special districts, as Chris said. Lots of legislation over the years, and as I said, there are several districts operating. Again, it's burdensome to set up. It takes coordination with special districts. There are a few operating. We have a few clients who are still using it. I wouldn't say it's a super popular, viable option at this point.
Does it have an end of date?
That's one of the sore subjects. So, theoretically, a good plan. When we did in Beaverton when I was there, we wound it up in less time than we said we would, and we gave a whole bunch of money back to all of our neighboring taxing districts. The idea is that a plan is supposed to have a date. Every urban renewal district that the entity that wants to carry out activities and collect money, they have to have a plan. And that plan is supposed to have a termination date, typically 20 years. The sore subject is that they keep extending them. And some entities have been notorious about doing that as opposed to winding them down or making a new one. And so that existing authority, they just keep extending. So there's no limitation on how they can do that, which you may see in the future if you haven't already.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many urban renewal districts do we have in the state?
You know, I don't know. Maybe some of the other speakers are qualified to answer. I know that we are working with maybe five. There's an organization, the league is here, they may be able to answer. There's an affiliated organization of the League of Oregon Cities called the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies, and they may have a complete roster that they can answer that question.
Thank you. We're aware of at least five.
Yeah. Again, it's a lot of information in a very short time. I apologize for having to rush. I hope it was useful. And don't forget about the paper when you get confronted next session. Dig it out, dust it off.
Thank you.
Any questions? Yes.
No.
Oh, you have to go. Yeah. Questions?
No.
I want to say thank you. I appreciate both of them. The little checklist is really helpful.
Great.
To remember. And at some point, we're going to get to the point where we say, do we need all of these? Is there ways to expedite it? And we'll probably get back to asking that question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, are there ways to think about this in a different way and make it a little less complex but consistent?
Yeah. You deserve an award if you figure it out.
Question. On that point, one bit of contention I've heard from cities is the fact that because certain annexation rules are embedded in city charters, that changing the statutory scheme, it would therefore require city charters to be changed to mirror that. Is that a concern? Does that make sense?
The exercise of home rule authority by cities in their charter is limited where the state what we call occupies the field or preempts city action. So it could. Mm-hmm. It could. So you could have the effect of effectively overriding local voters who have approved a charter and they want a certain, but that's inherent in state exercise of its authority.
Okay. Thank you.
What we see most commonly is actually the opposite, where cities add into their charters requirements that are not in state law.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So next, and can we get enough chairs up there? We might be able to. I have Dave Honeycutt, Aaron Doyle, Jerry Ritter, John Chandler, and Mark Landauer. If we can get all of you up there, that'd be great. Just pull a couple more chairs up.
Yeah.
You all agree on everything, so it makes it a lot easier that way. But even if you don't all agree, you share well. So that's... Oh, yeah, that's... So there's no microphone over there. I think you're there.
John need a mic.
Yeah, that's true. Only for recording purposes.
I think even then, need to project.
Even then are okay.
There you are.
And I'm not sure if we gave people an order in which they want to go, but we can go with the same order. Dave, you want to start?
Sure.
And again, I want to thank all of you for being willing to be here today on such a lovely day.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. I was talking with a lobbyist out in the hall who said that this date has special significance for a family, and there was a wedding scheduled this afternoon at 6 o'clock outdoors at a winery. So,
that must be sad.
Might not be the ideal place to hold a wedding on a day like today, but nevertheless, I suspect the show will go on. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on this issue. I really want to focus, and I'll be brief, on the relationship between land use law and annexation law, and that because for us that's where the problem lies. There's a real disconnect for the cities in Oregon that have voter-approved annexations, where the voters get the opportunity to vote whether to agree to annex property or not, and circumstances where land, for example, is brought into the urban growth boundary for the first time. When land is brought into the urban growth boundary, there's a determination that's been made by a local government and by LCDC, because that decision has to be reviewed and acknowledged by LCDC, that the community needs more land for development. There needs to be new commercial, industrial, or residential property that's brought in, and that determination then under state land use law is, once it's final, is becomes the determination that the city is stuck with. And at that point, that land that's brought into the urban growth boundary should be available for development under whatever type of zoning that's provided by the city. There's a disconnect between that policy, that state land use policy, and the voter-approved annexation requirements, and it's illustrated by a situation out in the town of North Plains in Washington County. Land was brought in by the city of North Plains, and their UGB was amended quite some time ago. North Plains is one of the cities that has voter-approved annexation, and this was bare land. This wasn't rural residential developed land. This was just bare farmland that was brought into the urban growth boundary, and of course the city, and very rightfully so, would not provide services to that particular area until the land was annexed into the city. I think that's certainly an appropriate policy. If you want city services as a property owner, you ought to be willing to annex into the city. If you don't want city services, then maybe you don't have to annex. But the city of North Plains, which had just brought this land in, refused to provide the services until the land was annexed, which I totally understand. But North Plains has voter-approved annexation. The land that was brought in was just on the other side of a road from a fully developed subdivision that was already within the city limits and was already receiving city services. So the landowners in that subdivision could look out across the road in a nice open field that they enjoyed, and they enjoyed that view. And so when it came time for the voter-approved annexation to annex this property in to provide the so that the owner of the property could get the services and then develop according to the city zoning, the voters rejected that request and have done so a couple of times since then. And so that land that was brought in sits vacant because the voters won't approve the annexation to allow the services to be provided.
Now, is that a charter requirement for the city?
Yes.
As opposed to, it isn't a, okay.
Yes. And so you have a disconnect there between land use policy and voter-approved annexations. Now, we tried to address that last session, Mr. Chandler and I did, with House Bill 4090 in the 2012 session that dealt with that problem, also dealt with the Area 93 issue, and also dealt with Representative Clem's annexation issue with the Marion Fire District. So it what we thought was a fairly simple bill quickly turned into Frankenstein's monster, which, you know, I'm not sure any of us wanted, but that's what happened to it. That bill got out of the House, but died over on the Senate side. So what we were trying to do there was provide that if you're inside the urban growth boundary where development is supposed to occur, and you're willing, you as the property owner are willing to pay for the service, and there's a service provider there that can provide the service, but won't do so either because you can't annex into the city, or in the case of the Bonnie Slope area, because all the services were in Washington County and this property was situated in Multnomah County or whatever. If you're willing to pay for it, you're entitled to the service. That bill, as I said, failed, was approved on the House side, but failed over on the Senate side, and we couldn't get it out. We fixed two parts of it, Representative Clem's part and the Bonnie Slope part this session, but we still have the bigger overall issue of voter-approved annexations out there. Mr. Chandler and I have been talking about ideas for the 2014 session to try and address that without doing violence to the notion that the voters ought to approve, be entitled to vote on annexations. And I think there's ways to do that, to sort of meld and better accommodate both viewpoints in that. And so I suspect that we'll be seeing both of these committees again in 14 with that kind of idea, and seeing if we can get some traction for that. The disconnect, something needs to happen, and we're hoping that it will be addressed sooner rather than later.
The one thing I might reference is often we're talking about these annexations in the land use arena, different people will be thinking different things. So I'll think about a heavily urbanized East Salem neighborhood that's built to density already. You might be talking about the Pick Suite property that's bare ground and the guy wants it annexed, and I'm thinking of all these people who've been there for 25 years built to density, and so then you got a further divide almost. Are we talking voluntary annexation by, you know, owner initiated, or involuntary by person already essentially, already preventing sprawl? You know, they just didn't do it within the context of an annexation.
Yeah. Well, Chair Clem, and I'll let Mr. Chandler talk in more detail about what we've been discussing. But that's exactly the road that that's where we're trying to get.
And I'll just say, my disconnect, having since I've been here now for 8 years, and a number of different times happened to be in positions where I had to deal with land use issues, the thing that has become clear in my head is that even though a lot of people thought Senate Bill 100 was a complete package, good forever, they forgot some major things. And for one of them is they make this new thing called the Urban Growth Boundary, but they didn't design how to do anything with it other than to say it's where you're going to grow next. And then it was left up to the courts and everybody else to figure out what that meant. When I first thought about it, even on the meetings, I thought, well, once you get involved, you should expect within 20 years you were in a city or not. I mean, that, if it was really truly done, then 20 years later, you should be in a city because that's what the design was. I don't care if it was an election or not election. That's what, to me, and yet it was never discussed in Senate Bill 100 what that meant at all. So it's a disconnect that I think we do need to figure out what we're talking about. Yes, and Lizana.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, Chair Roland, members of the committee. For the record, Erin Doyle on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. As you know, the League represents all 242 cities within the state of Oregon, and we try to have a statewide perspective on issues. But annexation is kind of a local issue in that it's possibly the most local issue, and then it's deciding who comes into your city and joins your municipality. Therefore, every city has adopted their own policies related to how they approach annexation in a way that best reflects their local community's characteristics and their vision for the city. And a lot of cities, as a result of a lot of things we've heard about conflict, have either formally or informally adopted a policy of only annexing when there's a consent. That just limits the amount of expensive litigation and expansive process that you have to go through because you have consent on both sides and everyone wants this. But it also that also has its own complicating set of slowing down expansions and delaying long-term planning. So you basically have to have all the stars aligned correctly. You have to have a property owner who wants to come in, a city that wants to grow, and the planning in place to get the extension of services out to that area. And that's a lot of stuff that has to happen all at the same time, even on a consent-based annexation. But I want to focus on three topics that kind of cover the broad issues that I've seen. First is the conflicts arising between land use planning laws and annexation. Second is the difficulty in funding infrastructure extensions. And third is that there are these political issues out there that aren't just easily resolved through a single shot of legislation. And the first point to the conflicts is, in fact, Chair Roblin's point is that when we passed, when Senate Bill 100 was passed in 1973, the annexation statutes predated the land use system, and there was no conscious decision to figure out how those two things overlaid one another. And so there's a lot of tension between the concept of an urban growth and an organized long-term planning process and how you go from planning to have areas of just outside the city brought into the city and how you get those areas actually into the incorporated boundaries. We had it, part of the Senate Bill 100 process is included in the goals, and one of those goals is about efficient planning of city expansions and infrastructure planning that should result in a progressive state of annexation as we need to grow and we need to accommodate more industry, as we need to accommodate more commercial use, as we need to accommodate more residences. We have to plan our infrastructure out that way in a way that we can show that we can pay for that infrastructure to expand. And in addition, that makes us consider how we use our resources efficiently. And not only are we conserving the important resource land that's out there that has a role in Oregon's history, but also conservation of our funds by trying to do as much efficiently with the infrastructure that we have. So maybe instead of building out, we build up or we build within. But that goes also to the construct of the buildable land supply that's developed as part of the UGB system. And a buildable land supply is basically an inventory of what we have available to increase development on. And when we do that inventory, we look at kind of what's inside the UGB. This is a very simplified version because that's the best I can do. But we do a kind of inventory everything, see what's around, see where we can grow, and that kind of sets up how much space we need in 20 years. And that 20-year buildable land supply is what we get in our UGB. And that includes areas that are expected to be annexed, which includes things like the islands within the city that are not incorporated but surrounded by the city. So if we can't annex those properties and we can't annex outside, we're kind of frozen in time with what's left in that UGB and that buildable land supply, because we can't justify growing UGB into an area where maybe residents want or folks want to come in and join the city because our buildable land supply sets our UGB size. And finally, there's that really sticky wicket of the very very well-developed unincorporated areas at the edge of town. It's most familiar in Washington, and Clackamas counties have a lot of those areas, but even here in Salem, we do have them, and there's the sticky wicket of those folks have all the infrastructure and services that they feel that they need and that they want, and that they're built up to, sometimes built up to a density that's completely appropriate in an urban area, but they remain unurban because they're outside of the city limits, and there's a conflict there between the purpose of having dense urban areas in cities, that was the goal of Senate Bill 100, is compact development to preserve our resource lands, which are pretty limited given how much is not even owned by the state at this point. So if there's resistance to annexation and those folks coming in, and we can't expand into other areas, that once again the city's kind of frozen, and we're leaving out those urban areas that should probably be part of the local municipal government, and they're taking advantage of some of the resources and infrastructures that we do have in place in the cities, but they're not paying into part of the tax base. And of course, taxes are a crux to all of this. Which leads me into the funding for infrastructure extensions. And first, to answer a question that was asked previously, I don't handle urban renewal districts, so I asked my colleague at the League how many urban renewal districts are we aware of in the state, and there's between 60 and 70 currently, to answer your question, Representative Frederick. And also to address the issue of reimbursement districts, just because, you know, as things go along, I pick up things. Some cities, in fact, do the development themselves in a reimbursement district and then have developers pay into the reimbursement district. So it's a pretty flexible tool, and one that I think exemplifies how local flexibility is super important in figuring out ways to finance. And finally, so some of the bigger points is that cities are currently trying to balance a really shrinking number of dollars to address both growth and maintenance. I commend to you our March 2013 Local Focus magazine, which is available on the League of Oregon Cities website. It's wanted $2 billion for city infrastructure, and that's not talking about extension of infrastructure. That's about improving the infrastructure that we currently have. So we have to balance that need against the need that we have when we grow out into these new areas as cities expand, because as more people want to come and live here, we have to put them in places, we have to give them jobs, and so we need land for that, we need to have services to that area. Incorporated into why some of those dollars are wanting is the inflexibility in the tax base that we've all heard enough about, but I just wanted to throw out there the words compression and tax base, because they really do play a huge role in what we can and cannot afford to do as far as infrastructure goes. Similarly, we need assistance in getting planning done so that we can have a plan on how we extend infrastructure out into areas. It's difficult to extend infrastructure into an area that's completely undeveloped, but then how do you extend infrastructure into an area that is partially developed or fully developed and integrate those into a single service? Because your water pipes got to line up, your streets should probably meet each other, because it's hard enough to drive when got six left turns and you're in the same place. So you want to have that planning out there, and that costs money, that costs, staff time, that costs part of what we do is planning, but we can't always afford to do all of it. So some of the local grants that the DLCD has provided have been invaluable to especially our smaller communities, but those dollars are shrinking. Similarly, federal dollars are shrinking, and those can help us plan the engineering part of it. It can help us lay out the roads. It can help us figure out how we can best create new and vibrant communities with multiple use things like that that mean we don't have to expand so wide. We can kind of expand internally. Other things that you can research about infrastructure mechanisms for payment on our website. We also, every 3 years approximately, do a survey of our cities to find out how many of them have SDCs currently, and there's currently one available from 2010, and we are in the process of starting up that survey for 2013. You'll see exactly how many of your cities have SDCs and what type of SDCs they do have, because certain cities elect to do certain processes, like either transportation or transportation and parks, or et cetera. Finally, to the political issues, one of the things when I was going back over some of the materials from 7 years ago when this big issue came up previously in a work group, there's a difficulty in the political process of getting folks involved in the planning at the long-term stage. It's a lot easier for folks to become involved when it's the not-in-my-backyard moment. And we need to find ways and resources to extend that knowledge base to citizens so that they can go out and kind of understand the comprehensive plan and UGB and all of those crazy things that have existed for 40 years, but people maybe don't recognize that they live within a UGB. I know that there are a number of cities that have, you know, the zoning maps have a very clear outline of where the UGB versus city limits are. Metro has a website. You can type in your address and figure out if you're inside a UGB or not. And those things are super helpful at getting people in the participating early on and understanding the ramifications of purchasing the property that they're purchasing. But there's little resources out there for cities other than, you know, the best we can do is sending out the notices that we always send out, putting stuff on the websites that we put out, and, you know, just going into neighborhood committees and things of that nature where we do the outreach that we can, but you need to still get people to participate earlier so that when we expand through annexation, there's an understanding of that this was part of the 20-year goal of the UGB. The UGB was 20 years, this is how big we'll be. Second, there's not just the folks who there are two folks, sets of folks that usually come up in the annexation discussion. There's ones that want to come in but can't because of either we can't extend our infrastructure, and a lot of our cities have decided that there will be no extension of extraterritorial extension of services because it's not financially responsible and it cuts down on the incentive to annex when we get to that area of property. And then there's the folks who just, they don't want their city to grow at all and they'll vote down the annexation, or the folks who just never want to come in. They like where they're living and they like the, you know, maybe it's not as dense in their area and they prefer to live in like a 1-acre piece of property, which you just don't get inside of a city limit. So there's a lot of strong groups that have an interest in the annexation process and have a lot of tools under the current system to delay that annexation, not just in voting, but also in extensive lawsuits. I mean, if you just search on Luba's site, annex, you get a lot of results. So there's a lot of disincentivization to growth and development. But I also wanted to say that we recognize that this is part of an ongoing conversation about how land use laws and annexation policies need to be developed in the future and want to be a part of that continuing conversation. But we also believe that cities need the flexibility to work with the members within our own community, other local governments in the state to find solutions that best reflect the character and vision we have for ourselves as part of our local control. I thank you for the opportunity and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chairs Clemen, Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. The Special Districts represent over 950 districts that provide a variety of services in the state of Oregon, including water, sewer, libraries, parks, rec, vector control. We even have a weather control district. Districts are generally governed by...
How's it doing?
I couldn't tell you on that at the moment, but I'll get back to you. Okay. Districts are generally governed by 5-member boards who volunteer their time for these various boards and do so in order to better their communities. Surprisingly to perhaps some, SDO, I'd just like to make it clear, generally does not oppose annexation. Many people have the belief that our organization opposes annexation, and quite frankly, we don't. Our view, our fundamental view, is people ought to be able to choose who their service provider is. That's our bottom line. If people want to become annexed into a city, fine, that's their choice, and we're not going to get in the way of that. But what we do get concerned about, and I believe that Ms. Berry and Mr. Crean touched upon it, was what happens to those districts, in fact, when annexations take place that remove a great deal of the value of a district from that district, and how are those services going to be continued for the remaining citizens. So I'll dive into that here shortly. The statute that really causes that sort of tension was mentioned in their presentation, ORS 222520. And that deals with partial annexations of district boundaries. There are instances where a city may, in fact, annex an entire district, and at that point, the district, for all intents and purposes, is extinguished. It's gone. However, in the majority of cases, at least the ones that I'm familiar with, are cases whereby a city will grow a little bit through annexation and take or split off a section of an existing district. And that can cause quite some trouble for a district, particularly when the district is involved in, for example, providing water. Districts or any type of municipal water supplier has to plan for water supply 50 years out into the future. And Chair Roblin is familiar with this. If suddenly a significant portion of your customers suddenly disappear through an annexation, that long-range planning really becomes fouled up, and you have to go back to the board and effectively start over. So planning for the infrastructure, for the storage, for the source of that water really can become quite challenging. And that brings me to why in 1993, again, Ms. Berry and Mr. Crean mentioned, we were supportive of Senate Bill 122, as were the counties and the cities, for that matter. In that legislation, there was something created called urban services agreements, and I'm sure some of you have heard about these before, although we are getting quite down into the weeds, I will say. It created a process by which cities, districts, counties would get together and try to plan, all right, who's going to serve what, when, how, and over time we're going to, as cities grow or districts grow, who's going to be serving whom and who's going to be the most efficient provider. Well, that became law in 1993, and regrettably, it really hasn't been utilized. In fact, SDAO pushed a budget note as a result of a bill that Mr. Honeycutt and Mr. Chandler were involved in last session, the 12th session, they mentioned it, 490, that asked LCDC to conduct a study on cities and counties with greater than 10,000 population who has an urban services agreement. Well, we polled 150 districts that fell within that broad category. Of the 50% that actually responded, out of approximately 75 who responded, only 19% of those districts said that they had valid urban services agreements. Why are those urban services agreements important to us? Well, they're important primarily because they require, as Mr. Berry or Ms. Berry and Mr. Crean mentioned, under ORS 195.075, what happens when territory is withdrawn from a special district? The statute requires that if an agreement calls for significant reductions in the territory of a special district, the agreement shall specify how the remaining portion of the district is to receive services in an affordable manner. The section also states that the agreements have to consider the financial integrity and operational ability of each service provider, whether it's a city, county, or district. So from our perspective, the annexation statutes are heavily tilted in the city's favor. And again, we're not going to quibble with that. It's that policy decision has been made. But what we're very interested in, what we need for that long-range planning, frankly, is the ability to have these agreements in place so that we can have that long-range planning for infrastructure as well. And quite frankly, we don't have it. And there are very many examples where this becomes a problem and becomes a food fight, oftentimes before this legislative body. Those food fights, for example, Marion County and Kaiser Fire District, perfect example. Other examples happen in the Santa Clara area, the River Road area, right outside of Eugene. These are notorious areas where these food fights occur. So despite the fact that there's a statutory requirement for these urban service agreements to be in place, they are expensive, they are time-consuming, they are filled with tension, but they are also very useful, and where they have been done, generally speaking, and I'm not saying that these are panaceas, but generally speaking, they have worked. And Washington County is a really good example. What is the county that has the most economic development going on? And I would submit it's Washington County. We have substantial employers who have predictability in their utilities and so forth. So we think that there's a real value to these, and so we're trying to figure out how do we get more urban services agreements put in place. Well, thankfully, the House anyway, and I, Chair Roblin, your colleagues here, have actually passed a bill that I think will incentivize these urban services agreements, however, in very narrow cases. And that was under House Bill 2254, which allows cities to go through an expedited urban growth boundary expansion process, provided they meet certain conditions. And we think that that's a good step forward. However, we did introduce, SDAO introduced House Bill 3124, which would have required cities and districts with over 5,000 population to have urban services agreements in place by 2015 if their populations were in excess of 5,000. We pulled that bill back. Why did we pull it back? Simply because we feel that the folks who are coming to the table to negotiate what are admittedly very difficult issues, sometimes sensitive issues, should be willing partners. And I didn't have much of an interest in forcing the cities to the table. I want them to come to the table so that we can work these things out. So this is a unfinished story at this point. I hope my colleague to my left here will be willing to entertain those conversations. Previously, she indicated that she would, but my hope is that we can find a way to enforce these urban services agreements so that we can avoid at least you having to choose between either Jell-O or spaghetti. So with that, I'd be happy to conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee and staff. Jerry Ritter, representing Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexations. OCVA is happy to be part of this conversation. We appreciate the opportunity. We were formed in 1996 with the purpose of guaranteeing and protecting the public's right to have a voice, a meaningful voice in annexation decisions, and also to address what we and many others felt were provisions in state annexation laws that effectively excluded people from that right. So our perspective on the topic comes from nearly two decades of dealing with annexation issues around the state. Our current issue of concern is hostage annexations, and I think you're all familiar with the problem, so I'm not going to go there. Instead, I think our purpose here would be better served by us giving you our take on why Oregon has these repeated annexation food fights, I guess is a good term, and what we might do to avoid them in the future. And we'd also like to talk a little bit about the infrastructure funding problem in the state. Let's face it, annexation battles are about money. In one scenario, people who are forced to annex are going to pay more in taxes, they're going to pay more in services, and so they're going to generally be opposed to annexation. Former General Electric CEO Jack Welch made the comment, if you don't provide a quality product at the best possible price, you're going to be out of the game. In the public sector, it's really no different, and that's why we have these wars when large numbers of people are forced to annex against their will. In the second scenario, annexations, especially larger ones, can cost a community quite a bit more than they bring in with taxes and fees. If For example, when the city of Springfield was considering annexing most of the territory within its urban growth boundary, the unincorporated territory, the city concluded that this would create an unfunded liability of about $24 million. The cost issue raises concerns with city folks who fear that they're going to end up subsidizing the new additions, and they respond by passing voter annexation charter amendments. We have 31 of those in place, as was noted earlier, around the state. Governor Kitzhaber's 1999 Task Force on Growth report explained it this way, quote, "The movement for voter approval of annexations derives in a large part from a belief that city governments do not fairly represent the interests of the people most affected by those annexations," end quote. Citizens want smart growth that's not a financial drain on their communities. They want an effective and meaningful voice in decisions that affect the destiny of their communities. Unfortunately, citizen opposition to annexations has caused conflicts with city governments and with development interests. Ultimately, if we want to avoid or mitigate these problems, we've got to find ways to make annexation more of a win-win proposition for everybody involved. We'd like to put a couple ideas on the table for you. First, is there a way or are there ways to buffer the cost hit that comes with annexation? Now, regarding the ability of citizens to vote on annexations, the legislature and the state's highest courts have repeatedly upheld that right. So we're suggesting that opposition to annexation votes be refocused toward making annexation more acceptable. Some examples. Can the tax hit be phased in over a longer period? Are people going to be forced to hook up to expensive sewers and other services right away? Is it absolutely necessary that special districts go away when their service territories are annexed? Are there other things we can do to improve the benefit-to-cost ratio so people will find annexation more palatable? Earlier this year, the city of Springfield approached us to initiate discussions on that very topic. Now, the outcome of that is unknown at this point, but we think the exercise will be time very well spent. Next item. Should we think about convening another annexation work group? Now, I know that in the wake of the Senate Bill 887 work group from 2007, there's going to be some reluctance to go down that road. But Chair Roblin, as we saw with your work group on House Bill 2760, when you were in the other chamber, such collaboration can work, it can produce results, and it did. We're willing to try that again. We'd like to be part of discussions in the future. And I think that's the only way that we're going to ever resolve this is to try to come to some agreement. And again, I understand the issues in the past weren't all that productive. We're willing to have another shot at it. Finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about our take on the infrastructure funding issue. Should we revisit the previous studies on the cost of growth in Oregon? Now, there have been many such studies. Some of them have concluded that growth pays its own way and then some. Others have disagreed very strongly. We think that the question has been answered by the Big Look Task Force, which found billions of dollars in infrastructure shortfall around the state. And now Metro has announced that it's expecting a $10 billion growth-related shortfall in infrastructure funding over the next 20 years. It would appear that we do have infrastructure funding problems in the state. What are the causes? The reports from the studies flag several things. The fall off in federal funding and grant money. And of course, measures 5 and 50 are big hitters. And statutory limitations on system development charges. Significantly, none of them that we've reviewed targets restrictions on annexation as a cause of infrastructure funding problems. Now, we repeatedly hear arguments that unincorporated residents are being subsidized by city voters. We provided your staff with this service incident study from Washington County, which finds something very different. And if you want to investigate that question, we'd suggest that you take a look at that. So, certainly annexation is part of the growth debate. But we don't believe that restrictions on annexation that have been placed by this body or citizens in local communities are part of the funding problem. We have not seen facts and data to support that. Revisiting the former studies on the causes of the infrastructure funding problem and what might be done about them, and some of that's already been done today by some of the former presenters, I think is a necessary first start. In conclusion, I'll just say that we certainly don't have all the answers to these questions, but we are willing to sit down and talk with all interested parties to see if we can come up with recommendations to make the annexation process more win-win and more acceptable. And at this point, I'd like to thank the legislature for all the support they've given us through the years toward our goals, and we very much appreciate that. And thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
What we've found is if it's a very large investment into a community that you're going to add, a part that you're going to accent, so it has a high value, mm-hmm. and that doesn't want any services, those seem to work pretty well. The ones that have high value but have high expectations, those are harder ones to kind of pay off. Yes. Mr. Chandler.
I think I can go from here. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I can't express how delighted I am to be revisiting annexation and Mr. Ritter's notion about reconvening the task force. I think it's an excellent one. Unfortunately, I'm busy that entire time. This is a delightful issue, as you all know, and I was reflecting as we were talking with the other speakers were talking. In 1997, we brought a bill forward along with the Oregon Association of Realtors, the Governor's Office, DLCD, and the Housing Agency to repeal the right to annexation voting. And if I remember correctly, we made it out of the Senate, died in the House, and we filled up at one point. We were on our third overflow room. I swore up and down I would never, ever do that again, although it is tempting just for the sheer entertainment value of it. Our perspective on this issue is primarily dealing with bare land. We tend not to get involved in those checkerboard issues that you guys make your phone ring from constituents who just as soon not be annexed, thank you very much. We tend to be involved with the urban growth boundary expansions or land inside urban growth boundaries that's supposed to be developed. And from it has to do, from our standpoint, with urban services, water, sewer, transportation, and so forth. And we are completely agnostic. We love our friends in the cities. We love our friends in the districts. We love our friends in the counties equally and more or less without reservation. And we couldn't care less who provides the services. We simply want the necessary urban services that come before development to occur. That's where we get into this discussion. And I think that one of the things to keep in mind is you have two very different contexts there. The checkerboard type annexations where if you don't have a map in front of you, it all looks like town, but part is city, part is county, part is city, part is county. Those are entirely different from bringing in some raw land for development purposes. The underlying law isn't necessarily see that distinction, but the politics of it, the angst about it in the community, and what you could do about it as a matter of policy going forward, I think you have to treat those entirely separately. From my standpoint, the checkerboard type annexation is, as much as anything else, a sales problem for the city. If you are not providing services to those residents that are equal to or exceed the amount of tax or other sort of regulation they may incur by annexing, then the city has a sales job to do about why people should annex, or a pricing policy to institute. I personally have a piece of property in one of the hotbeds, vacation home in the Rhodes End area of Lincoln City. I've been tried to get the folks that want to fight the annexation have tried to recruit all the property owners out there. We signed a non-remonstrance agreement when we bought the property because we wanted to continue having water come on when we turned the tap. I don't have any problem annexing. I think people who live outside of city using city services ought to annex. That's my own personal opinion. As a matter of policy for this body and future discussions, though, different people see that very differently. And I think, again, those checkerboard-type annexations need to be treated separately, and I use that term not as a term of art, but to describe the pattern of boundaries, versus the type that I get involved with and get concerned about, which is the urban growth boundary expansions or land for development. With regard to those, the land use implications of this issue, even though the Supreme Court, in an opinion that would only fool lawyers, saw a distinction between voting on annexation that isn't a land use issue and the land use component of annexation, which they recognize, that there really is a land use issue here. And part of the land use issue goes to the fact that of the 31 cities that Mr. Ritter's group represents, many of them are smaller towns. And I think you can trace back the underlying problem to our inability, since Senate Bill 100 was passed, of figuring out what to do with small towns. There seems to be this unspoken assumption that every city in the state over time turns into Beaverton or Portland. And there are many cities, and many of the ones on Mr. Ritter's membership, that don't want that. And so annexation voting was a tool that they adopted to try to stave that off, whether it be Sisters or Philomath or some of these others, that knew where the city was. Folks living in these little towns knew right where it was, and that's why they didn't move there. They weren't ignorant, just didn't drive far enough. They liked the little town. They want to keep it that way. They saw, you see annexation as a way of creeping urbanization that they weren't fond of. So I think part of the discussion has to be and go back to our land use system and some of the underpinning theories of it to make sure that we're respecting people's right to live where they want, to have development around them that they're comfortable with, and that the small towns are left to be small towns, not necessarily turning into the Pearl District. The other problem is that annexation voting can sometimes, particularly in larger communities, be an end run around the land use planning system, in the sense that you've made a decision to grow and develop in a certain part of town, but the people in the community can vote against annexation, which means they get to be for planning, but nothing actually happens. So they get the political benefit of being in compliance with Oregon land use law, but the practical benefit of not actually seeing anything happen. One of the properties that was a poster child for Senate for House Bill 4090 in the 2012 session that's been mentioned was a piece of property outside of Oregon City, which has annexation voting. It's inside the Urban Growth boundary, and this particular piece of property has been inside the Urban Growth boundary since the Urban Growth boundary. It's been there since for 30 years. And because Oregon City requires annexation voting, it's just sitting there, not developing, but being counted by the system as though it is. And that's one of the things that causes us to come to the table to want to get this problem fixed, at least for that piece of it. I don't know about the checkerboard part, but at least the development side, because our land use system says any property inside an urban growth boundary is presumed available for development. We have a 20-year land supply requirement under House Bill 2254. Now there'll be, for certain cases, a 14-year land supply requirement. But in any event, some amount of land inside a boundary that's available for future development, which implies, I think, that at some point it could develop. But it can't if you don't have water and sewer and transportation. So this infrastructure is a critical piece from our standpoint. Again, like I said earlier, regardless of whether it's a city or a county or a district that provides it. And so by allowing annexation voting, oftentimes you can create that disconnect. And I'm taking nothing away from Mr. Ritter's folks. I understand the problems they're trying to address, but we simply have done a lousy job of figuring out how to reconcile those competing interests, and instead we've covered our ears and hummed loud and pretend they didn't exist. And that's what's caused the bill in 1997. It's what's caused periodic headbutts over the years. It caused 4090 to come forward, is trying simply to get to this body and say, this is a problem. You can't have 20 years worth of land if X amount of it is off limits as a practical matter. So there, I think there's several things we could think about going forward. And I do think the idea of convening a group probably does make sense, because having three dozen bills every session is untidy, if nothing else. And I think some way of actually getting serious about this issue probably is meritorious. But there's a bunch of different possible fixes you could do. One of them is simply to recognize you have this conflict in land use law and annexation law, or land use policy and annexation policy, and address both of them at the same time. For example, under 2254 on boundary expansions going forward, the annexation issue is handled at the same time as the boundary move, so that we decide when we move an urban growth boundary from this point forward into that context, who's in a city, who's in a district, who's providing water, who's providing sewer, and all of those things are done. Metro has a similar requirement on their code book. I don't recall the title number, doesn't matter, but where anything going on in the metro area from that point forward will be taken care of. So already the problem set we've got is land currently inside of urban growth boundaries, which is a fair amount. They've got to keep us busy for a couple of days anyhow. But part of, I should have mentioned at the outset too, one of the things we're bringing to the table, and it's important to repeat, we're not looking for a free ride. We developers are not looking for a free ride. We're willing to pay for the water and sewer and transportation and all that, whether through an SDC, through a development agreement, through some other form of municipal financing. We understand there's costs that need to be borne. We're not looking for anybody to give us free sewer. We take it if it was offered, but we're not looking for it. we can, I think, look at ways to do that. 4090 was an attempt to say the developer could pay for the line extensions, the city could annex or not at its leisure, but at the very least we could get the development going pursuant to the land use plan. That I still think in some cases may be a very viable option if a city simply can't figure out a way to annex the property. Again, if it develops the urban densities under a special district water and sewer, under county zoning, it doesn't make a lick of difference. You're still getting the land use benefit of that development occurring where it's supposed to occur. Another option might be to put counties back in urban services business under some circumstances. There's sort of been a trend over the, and again, not living down any place necessarily, that cities should be the ultimate providers of urban services. In most cases, that's correct. In many cases, particularly in the metro area, that may not make as much sense. We're seeing that play out potentially up in Damascus in Clackamas County, where the city can't decide whether or not it's a city. It's actually going to vote on it here a little bit. If they decide to uncity, well, the only place left, given their geographic location, is Clackamas County, who has been trying to get out of the urban services business for quite a while, and that may not work for them. Another idea, and this is simply addressing the land use issue, is to say that land subject to annexation voting can't be counted as towards the buildable lands inventory. In other words, it doesn't exist for purposes of land use plan. You have a 20-year supply of land minus this chunk here that can't develop until such time as annexation occurs, and then we can put it back into the inventory. Now, from our standpoint, that might work just fine. From a land use planning standpoint, it may not work at all, because what that does then is take land, I'll use the Oregon City example, which is absolutely good developable land. If it doesn't come online, if it stays outside the inventory as though it's out in the middle of Harney County someplace, then that puts pressure in the metro area on land, primarily resource land out in Washington County or elsewhere, which is exactly contrary to what the land use system is supposed to be doing in the first place, but is a natural outcome of not being able to develop on the property where it's designated for growth in the first place. And yet one final option, which isn't legislative but might be kind of interesting, would be to find a case and tee it up and see if the Supreme Court wants to take another look at the Corvallis case. I personally think it was poorly decided. They probably don't care what I think one way or the other, but it might be kind of interesting with a few more years of land use planning experience under our belt and some of these disconnects that have been mentioned as part of the case to be brought forward. That might be worth doing. That's a much longer term idea, of course, than the legislative aspect, but it might be worth thinking about. Finally, I want to revisit what others have said, and that is you cannot talk about this issue without talking about the money. Annexation does not by itself bring any revenue other than off the taxes from that annexed property once it develops, and thanks to Measure 5 and Measure 50, the taxes off the annexed property ain't what they should be. And I think we've got to recognize, we collectively, this body, you'll have other opportunities. We kind of whiffed it this time, but there'll be other opportunities in the future to, when we're every time this legislature looks at tax reform, some of you have heard this speech from me before, and I'm going to make it again. Every time this body talks about tax reform, it focuses on state taxes. State does not have a tax problem. State has a spending problem. Good years, income tax year over year provides plenty of money. All y'all have to do, if you pardon me saying so, is not spend it all the time. A rainy day fund gets us through recessions. The local governments are going broke, every one of them. It's just a matter of time under the restrictions of Measure 5 and Measure 50. Some of them have been able to cover it up with cash flow, but it's still, they're still not profitable. And some of them, unfortunately, the ONC counties are the leading indicator, are about to go belly up on us, and that's a shame. We've got to fix the taxing problem and put some more money back in the pockets of local government, or at the very least give them the ability to raise money if they deem it necessary. Without that piece, addressing Measure 5 and Measure 50 and some of the other funding tools that have been taken away, they simply can't compete, which means they can't provide the infrastructure, which means the annexation by itself doesn't get you anywhere. So I would encourage you to keep those three, and it'll keep you busy for a couple of days, Mr. Chairman and members. You're talking about land use policy, you're talking about annexation policy, you're talking about tax policy. That's a work group for you. Again, I regret that I'm busy, but I'll be more than happy to, read the report when it's done. I'd be glad to take any questions.
I'd like to point out I did not pay him to put that forward. But
oh, you will. You will.
Beth was over here indicating she was really ready to go for this work group. So.
Well, she told me before the meeting, Mr. Chairman, that she could hardly wait.
Any questions? Yes.
I just feel as though you've been avoiding me. I wanted to hear that speech as well, so I'd like to have. at some point, I, and to be more serious about it, I really would like to see that kind of a list of ideas and concerns. that we can work with. Portland is a different different beast altogether when it comes to urban growth, urban renewal boundaries and all those kinds of things. But I am curious about how the rest of the state's dealing with it, because I'm curious about the rest of the state. So if you can, if you have some of those ideas, I really would like to hear, at least have a list of them if you can send them to me.
We have to, I think we can probably come up with that. And, Mr. Chairman, I would guess you have your first volunteer for the task force.
There we go. There. Hey, did I just do that, really?
You might have. I don't get to a point or anything, but you got my vote.
Any other questions for this group? Okay. I want to say thank you to all of you. As is the case in this particular arena, a lot more questions than answers yet. But I do believe that we're going to have some real serious conversations about how we move forward in our state. I thought the Oregonian puts this deal every 10 years or so about the different regions, the coast and the whatever. And there's a part of me that thinks that when we had Big Look, I would have loved to them to say, there are places where we should really look at the growth. As was mentioned, some cities don't want to get bigger. They like where they are, they enjoy their facility, and they have built an economy and a lifestyle around that. But the state has to have some places that are engines for that economy. We used to have it when we had timber that there was being sold, there was an engine that was there. And then now it's become, the metro region that is kind of the engine for most of that. But we need more than one engine at a time. We need to have a diversity of that. And I think there are different places that Big Look could have said, this is a place we need to think of in a different way. And it needs to, we need to look at infrastructure, we look at other things. I look at Coos Bay only because the port is there, and I see over time the ships are going to get too big to go up to Columbia. If we want to play in that market, we better figure out what we're going to do as a state. And it's a regional and a state thing that we have to come to grips with. And we haven't really had those conversations as a state. We kind of let it be. And I hope that through some of this, we can start having conversations about how we continue to have a viable economy in this whole state that works to make it all work better.
If I might plant a marker on that thought, Mr. Chairman, very few of the industrial lands bills are going to make it through this session, unfortunately. One of the things that we've tended to do is we've locked jurisdictions in, and this goes back to land use mumbo-jumbo in the sense of population forecasting, that if you were a small timber town, you remained a small timber town, and you were required to plan as though you were going to do that. And we've really taken away, particularly from rural communities, the ability to pick their change their destiny, to pick a different trajectory. Sometimes it's very aspirational, sometimes it might not work, but we've sort of taken away that laboratory and said, no, you have to trudge along the same path that you trudged along the last 25 years that got you here. Some way of building in some experimentation and recognizing that it may not work and it may cost some money and it may go boom, at least allows you to build those extra engines elsewhere than hoping Intel opens up another expansion plant in Washington County. Right. Whether it be in Coos Bay or Burns or Ontario, it doesn't matter, but our system doesn't really allow that. In fact, it penalizes that, and I think that's a mistake.
And we get visions about places. So we have this vision about Eastern Oregon. It's going to always be the small places. But, the vision of, if that was Idaho's vision, they would never have anything, because that's kind of what they all are, And we forget that these different places have opportunities if we had that vision to be whatever they want to be. And it could be, rail lines, all sorts of things that we haven't envisioned. And yet Baker City is about the same size Baker City's been for a long, long time. Any other thoughts or concerns? Again, thank you very much for being here, and thanks for giving us the information that we can start trying to play in our heads with as we get ready for our next sessions. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will adjourn our
meeting. Nicely done.